for daring to ask a question.
They're trying to silence us. We won't back down.
On the Senate floor, several Democrats wondered if this can be done to a U.S. senator asking about the treatment of his constituents in a room filled with media. Imagine what they're doing to powerless people in secret. Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts.
Every day, Donald Trump is making this nation look more and more like a fascist state.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
The Department of Homeland Security's notified more than 500,000 Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans they have to leave the country. They were sent termination notices. The temporary permission to live and work in the U.S. under the Biden administration has been revoked, ending their humanitarian parole program. The House has voted to cut $9.4 billion in spending, narrowly passed Thursday, with cuts targeting foreign aid programs and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which provides funding for thousands of community and public radio and TV stations around the country. The vote was 214 to 212. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, June 13, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show, and of course live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today is a special presentation of our Undocumented and LGBTQ series, The Caravan Within the Caravan. And today's episode takes us to Peru to examine the unique historical and political challenges of the country's LGBTQ community. And so with us today for the first time is Malú Machuca Rose. Malú is a PhD candidate in performance studies at Northwestern University. Malú has a recent article in NACLA entitled "Cuerpex en Vela, Transvesti Performance Against the Necro State." Welcome to the show, Malú Machuca Rose.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely, and thank you for being with us on this Pride Month. I'll tell you the same thing before we started recording, that the challenges faced by Peru's LGBTQ community can lead us to start in a million different directions. But you begin in your NACLA article with two cases that speaks volumes to the lack of government empathy for this community. Could you tell us about the cases of Ruby Ferrer and Priscilla Guado and how they serve sort of as a microcosm, not only to what you address in your article, but also the historical anti-LGBTQ sentiment in Peru? This sort of thing manifests itself in a lot of ways in Latin America. Tell us about the unique challenges in Peru here with these two cases.
Yeah, so both Ruby Ferrer and Priscilla Guado were trans women who had migrated from the Amazon area of Iquitos into Lima, which is number one important thing to mention. They were internal immigrants within Peru. And they both had migrated to the capital because, similar to a lot of South American countries, all of the opportunities are concentrated on the capital. So they had decided to leave their families, move to the capital city to try to be economically solvent, you know, try to have a future for themselves. And they were victims of what is happening right now to a lot of people in Peru. In fact, extortions have gone up significantly over the last 2 to 3 years under this government, who has refused to do anything to really tackle the situation with organized crime. But basically, they had started to be threatened via their social media, in person. Now, this is happening to a lot of folks, from schools to people who sell juice in the corner, like vendedores ambulantes, you know, people who work in food carts. Everybody is being victim of extortion right now. And so they were being extorted. This is something that's been going on for sex workers, and particularly for trans sex workers, for a really long time. That's not news. They're used to being extorted by the police. They're used to being extorted by pimps or by people asking for a fee in order to maintain their safety. But in this case, the threats escalated a lot higher than they usually do. While as sometimes, maybe if somebody defies a threat, they can get beaten up or whatever. In this case, not only were they both murdered, but their murders were recorded on their own phones. And these videos were sent via WhatsApp to the organized groups of trans sex workers that they were a part of. So they were sent both as a promise fulfilled that if you do not pay the fee, that you will get murdered. But they were also sent as a form of collective terror to sort of create this idea that, you know, trans women will not be protected by anybody. And so it's now been a couple of years since their death. And every year after that happened, that was in 2024 and 2025. In both years, there have been really big marches protesting because the government refuses to do anything to bring their captors to justice, even though there's a lot of information on who committed the crimes.
And just to reiterate something that you mentioned in your article, is that while these numbers are high, they could possibly be even higher because the state basically neglects these particular types of homicides. And so that sort of segues into, as you describe, one of the most, if not the most unpopular president in Latin America, which is current Peruvian president, quote unquote, Dina Boluarte. Can you describe to us Peru's lack of LGBTQ protections under the law and how current president Dina Boluarte has no interest in making improvements? As a matter of fact, based on your article, it seems like she's passing laws, one particular law, that is counterproductive to everything that you mentioned that is sorely needed for this community when it comes to this issue of homicides and femicides, as you describe in your article.
Yeah, so Dina Boluarte, I mean, she's not only disliked, we fully consider her a dictator. She rose up to power by very sort of, you know, ambivalent means. And for feminist communities and queer people all over Peru, like, nobody considers her our president. It's really difficult to know that the first woman president of Peru is actually a dictator. It's horrible. But, you know, already Peru did not provide many protections for the LGBTIQ community. But under her, there was a law passed, a decreto supremo. So, like, what would be the comparable word in U.S. law? Like a supreme decree that basically states that LGBTIQ people are mentally ill And now, most recently, another law has been passed to forbid people from using a public restroom that does not match their sex assigned at birth. So she's basically making it impossible for trans and non-binary people to use public restrooms without the fear of violence by the police, or even by, which was all a situation that already was being faced by people who might take this as an opportunity to take justice into their own hands, punish you, beat you up, etc. So it's really, you know, when you are making it harder for trans and non-binary people to be a part of public life, to go to a park, to go to a concert, to go to school even, and not being able to use the public restroom, is really saying, you know, we don't want you anywhere. And that's been a really huge blow for a lot of people who are organizing to protest this law around this Pride Month.
Absolutely. And let me just say one thing about Dina Boluarte that you just mentioned, that she's the first female to be the president of Peru, but also a dictator at the same time. It sort of reminds me of that situation with Jeanine Añez in Bolivia of several years ago. And I bring up her name because I think one underlying thing between both Boluarte and Añez, and this is something that's not necessarily mentioned in your article, but I think it's worth addressing here, which is this, what I would call this Christianized fascism that is not only pushing this anti-indigenous sentiment in these particular countries, but also the anti-LGBTQ sentiment as well. And so with that said, though, the only thing I would say in fairness to Boluarte is that she did not invent this by herself. I mean, we have to hold other politicians and other generations of politicians in Peru accountable, because this didn't happen in a vacuum in this recent decade or in this recent century. It's been institutional for decades. And so as unpopular as Boluarte may be with the LGBTQ community, do you find former President Pedro Castillo equally emblematic of the institutional homophobia and transphobia in the country? He ran as a leftist, but a lot of people, even who were supporters of him, pointed out this particular issue of homophobia and transphobia, and we see the results. And so, again, it's not about the individuals here, but about an institutional structure that has been historically homophobic and transphobic.
Yeah. So with that, there's a really important factor to mention within Dina Boluarte, which is that the only reason that she's in power right now is because she's made a pact with the Fujimorista forces. So these are the forces that the political force that was gained and has been sustained by a previous dictator, Alberto Fujimori. You know, he was one of the first presidents to be condemned for human rights violations. He was imprisoned for a long time. He was only released from prison by Dina Boluarte. Like, his forces tried to have him released from prison for multiple years without success, and it was only under her that he actually got released. And he is the one who said she will remain as president until 2026, and that's why she's there. So she's totally made a pact with previous dictatorship forces, which are what is upholding her power. And the Fujimoristas are famously extremely conservative with regards to gender equality. And we're talking any type of gender equality, even sexual health education programs in schools. You know, they are responsible for the forced sterilization program that forcibly sterilized almost 300,000 majority indigenous people in Peru. And they're actually on trial right now in the International Human Rights Court because of this. There's an emblematic case happening right now under the name Celia. So it's her three daughters are actually testifying on her behalf because she died after one of these forced sterilizations. But so this is coming from a long line of authoritarian regimes that are sort of sustaining themselves on top of one another. But yeah, you mentioned Pedro Castillo, and the truth is that when he was running for president, it was very romanticized because him and Dina speak Quechua, and he was hailed as like the first like indigenous leader of Peru, and he had a lot of indigenous people and indigenous leftist communities supporting him. And even a lot of queer and feminist people were like, okay, if this is who the people want, if this is going to be somebody who's going to bring justice, if this is, you know, what the majority of people think is a new hope, like, we will back him up. And a lot of queer people, queer and trans people, actually supported his campaign, even though he was not actually willing. He was extremely conservative. And he's part of that sort of, that part of the left that is still extremely recalcitrant when it comes to LGBTQ rights, women's rights. So he represented kind of like the old left, you know, in comparison to Veronica, I'm forgetting her last name, but she was the other left candidate who represented the more, you know, the new left, who actually was, she had a trans person running for Congress, Gaela, and she almost made it in. And so, yeah, so Pedro Castillo really represented sort of the most conservative side of the leftist movement in Peru. And sadly, you know, that was something that the right weaponized and instrumentalized in order to get ahead and sort of get him to set himself apart from the more socially progressive parts of the movement.
So just to be clear, were you referring to Veronica Mendoza?
Veronica Mendoza, sí.
Yes, Veronica Mendoza. So before we continue, I just want to address something both to you and the WPFW audience, that this is one of two, possibly three shows that we're doing this month with regards to LGBTQ rights. And one of the things that has come across over the years as we've done this undocumented and LGBTQ series, we refer to it as the caravan within the caravan, because there are oftentimes, and we have to be quite honest amongst ourselves, that people within leftist movements who are sincere and honest with a variety of issues when it comes to social justice, but when it comes to LGBTQ rights, it sometimes becomes a different story and a counterproductive story. And so we have to be honest with ourselves that there are people within our community that we would call leftists that can sometimes have transphobic and homophobic views on this particular community. And this is precisely why we do these particular types of programs. And in the case of Peru, it's no different. In the case of Pedro Castillo, as you mentioned, it's no different. And for Pedro Castillo to sort of appease the anti-LGBTQ people within Peru, usually right-wing types, is a cynical form of incrementalism that goes nowhere and appeals to nobody in the end. But I sort of digress. I just wanted to bring that up during the course of this conversation. The other thing I want to address that you just mentioned is the issue of authoritarianism. Because what is transphobia and homophobia in the context of Peru, but a form of or an expression of the patriarchy, which isn't addressed often enough in these cases, but I think it's certainly the case in Peru, that all this fear and paranoia of LGBTQ people, particularly trans people, is a reaction from the patriarchy, the fear and paranoia of the other, whoever the other might be. And again, I may be digressing, but I'm curious to know if I'm sort of reading your article in the right way when I bring this up.
No, I think that, you know, I like this idea of the caravan within the caravan, because something that I mentioned in my article is the idea of la cola, right? The ones that are in the back, like left behind, like la cola, and trans folks as la cola dentro de la cola, meaning like within the most dispossessed, disenfranchised people, you know, who might encompass working class communities, indigenous communities. You know, for example, in Peru, you know, this is called undocumented and LGBTQ. You know, the majority of undocumented people in Peru are trans people.
Really?
Because there's no gender identity law. So it is impossible for you to get an ID with your name. And because there's an incongruence between how you appear and your sex assigned at birth, sometimes what will happen is the smaller offices that are supposed to assign, kind of like the DMV in within the different regions, they will refuse to give people IDs, or people will outright not, you know, you don't want to have an ID that does not represent you. So you'll just will not get an ID. So even over people who do not read or write, even over people who live in extremely rural spaces that the state barely can reach, the majority of undocumented people in Peru are actually trans people, particularly trans women. And this is a huge issue when it comes to accessing medical treatment, for example, right?
Like yes.
accessing, you know, having a bank. So that means that you're carrying all your money with you wherever you go. And that makes you also more of a victim for extortion and more of a victim for people who are trying to take fees for safety. So, you know, I think I talk a little bit about that. I talk about this idea of la cola y la cabeza in my article, but it's really talking about how, you know, sort of the union between these two people, la cabeza or the head of the movement, meaning the front lines, you know, the people that often go on the front line of protests or on the front line of any type of battle, you know, is often younger people, browner people, poorer people, right? And la cola, the ones that are behind, is trans people. And so what I wanted to explore is also like, what is the relationship between these two groups? Because oftentimes, you know, as with Pedro Castillo in his rhetoric and Dina Boluarte, the rhetoric is very much as if there was nothing joining these two together. And actually in Andean mythology and how I see it in our reality, there's actually a lot of things getting these two groups together, right? Like, and in particular, the kind of oppression, the kind of violence, the kinds of death that these two groups are exposed to are the same. And that's really what I wanted to highlight because, you know, there's a lot more we can do to be in a coalitional alliance with each other. There's a lot more things that bring us together than divide us. Like, we cannot let these people divide us. And that's, you know, that's one of the things I wanted to say in this article.
Fantastic. You made a lot of good points so far with regards to homophobia and transphobia in Peru, which really can be conveyed as universal and applied to every other similar community in various other parts of Latin America and the Caribbean. But one thing that is unique to Peru with regards to this case is the concept of el terruqueo. So for those unfamiliar with Peruvian politics and history, could you explain the concept of el terruqueo and how does it undermine the struggle for LGBTQ rights? This is something unique to Peru. It sort of clouds whatever attempts the LGBTQ community has in trying to mobilize in a way that they probably could in other parts of Latin America, but it's a unique challenge in Peru.
Yeah. So terruqueo is a really interesting phenomenon that has been, you know, the name is Peruvian. It has actually, I think it happens here too. I think it's happening right now under the Trump government. But really what it is the assignation of people who are fighting for change to be terrorists. So, you know, during the civil war in Peru, which lasted from 1980 to 2000, the war was mostly between two big factions, right? Shining Path, which had a whole subversive guerrilla army of people, and then the state, which also through its use not only of the military, but also of paramilitary forces actually also became terrorist. And so in this battle, the Fujimoristas were actually the ones, so in the 90s, who started naming the other as a terrorist. So anybody who was opposed to the state and to its practices, and particularly, you know, Fujimori established a neoliberal regime with the 1993 constitution, they were seen as terrorists. So most of the people who are assigned as terrorists or terruco, which is the it's a sort of like a pejorative of terrorist, were actually human rights organizations fighting for the disappeared and the people who had been murdered without proper accusations, because this was a time where almost 70,000 people were killed or disappeared. Also, people with progressive or leftist political positions and indigenous communities, right? And this idea of assigning the other as terruco, as terrorist, has remained as a way to justify extreme forms of violence, including imprisonment, disappearance, and murder, including extrajudicial murders of people, which is sort of what I'm denouncing happened around the protests that saw Dina Boluarte rise up to power, right? She disowning everything that the Peruvian intelligence organization was telling her, she kept saying, no, the people who are protesting me coming into power, they are terrorists. And therefore, she justified in this way what a lot of international human rights organizations have deemed as extrajudicial killings. So 49 people were murdered by the military during that time, even when they were not doing anything violent. Like, I write in my article particularly about the deaths that occurred in Ayacucho, which are so, so painful because Ayacucho is the region that was the most hurt during the civil war in Peru. It had 40% of all those who were murdered and disappeared during that time were from Ayacucho. And it's one of the poorest regions in Peru. It's actually Ayacucho in Quechua means the corner of the dead. So it's very poetic in that way. But there were people who were murdered crossing the street. There were people who were murdered coming out of their house to attend to somebody who was wounded. And so these are not people that were in any way engaging in some cases, not even engaging in protest, but in the majority of cases, engaging in protest in peaceful manner. And they were murdered by the military. And so this is a way of marking, you know, human rights organizations, indigenous communities, leftist and progressive activists, terrorists. And sadly, the same thing has also translated to a lot of trans and gender nonconforming people, where this assignation sort of becomes this idea of, like, if, for example, indigenous people are seen as economic terrorists because they're defying the neoliberal, you know, a lot of indigenous and environmental activists are trying to defend their territories against mining companies, companies that are trying to extract resources from Peru, and they're seen sort of as economic terrorists or terrorists against the state. A lot of queer and trans people are seen as gender terrorists, right? Terrorists against the social order, or even, you know, something that was a fight here years and years ago, which is particularly in educational settings, you know, they're seen as terrorists against the children. And so this idea that queer and trans bodies produce the same forms of terror because it's the same regime that marks indigenous bodies as terrorists as well, that's something that has helped authoritarian regimes justify violence. So justifying why police is violent against them and justifying why they do not quite see queer and trans people as citizens or see them as enemies of progress. It's really a way of marking everyone who is trying to create change as an enemy of the state.
The unique political history of Peru's civil war is very hard to crystallize. Absolutely. You did a great job of crystallizing there. But at the same time, because it's so hard to crystallize, it could be easily manipulated by the boluartes of the world who are trying to paint everyone as a terrorist or terroqueo, as is described in Peru. And the tough thing about discussing that history is that, as you mentioned, yes, there were leftist groups that became terrorist organizations. And there were some atrocities committed. One case that comes to mind is the case of Maria Elena Moyano, which is a one-hour nuanced conversation in and of itself.
Yeah.
But that still does not give the state, especially under a right-wing government, does not give the state the right to paint everyone as a terrorist. Essentially, it's a euphemism for internal security, which is by itself also a euphemism for war against your own population. And so with that said, we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Malú Machuca Rose, who's a PhD candidate in performance studies at Northwestern University. Malú's recent article in NACLA is entitled Cuerpex en Vela, Transvesti Performance Against the Necro State. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Bien
Chacaloni, La Nueva Crema, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone, you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to the latest installment of our undocumented and LGBTQ series, The Caravan Within the Caravan, as it takes us to Peru for this hour. And we're speaking with Malu Machucarose, who's a PhD candidate in performance studies at Northwestern University. Malu's recent article in NACLA is entitled Cuerpex en Vela, Transvesti Performance Against the Necro State. And so, at the center of your article, and we cannot ignore this at all whatsoever, but I want to go now to the issue of art and how art's used to address a lot of these issues that you've mentioned so far. Could you tell us who is Yerma Machuca in your article?
Yeah, so Yerma Machuca is an amazing travesti performance artist. I have to say she's also my kin. She is my fairy godmother. And she has been doing work in Peru since the 80s, not only artistic work and political work, but also she has doing a lot of the work of care. This is to say that she has been taking care of HIV positive people since the beginning of the HIV AIDS epidemic.
And you had the pleasure of interviewing her for this article as well, correct?
Yes, yes, yes. I've interviewed her a bunch of times, but I interviewed her a couple more times for this article. And I also got to see this performance live in Ayacucho and help her throughout this performance. So I was actually an active participant of the performance itself. I was the person who was passing passing out the names of the dead during the performance. And if you get to read the article, you'll understand a little bit more about how that's situated. But yeah, let's just say that being in one of her performances is the honor of a lifetime. And she has been doing a lot of work, taking art out of galleries and museums and into plazas and public spaces where art can be for the people and not just for the ones that can pay for it.
Absolutely. And obviously we're on the radio for this conversation, but I'm curious to know if you're able to describe to us the image that's in your article. And before you do, I just want to make it clear to everyone that we are going to create a link to your article on a Twitter account so people can learn more about this. But is it possible for you to describe the picture, the first picture that people will see in this article?
Yeah, so the image that I have of her in the article, I'm really grateful to photographer Joseph de Araujo for taking this image and allowing me to use it. But it is an image of her standing in a room, and she is dressed as a bride in all white. She's actually wearing a white pollera, this traditional to Ayacucho. And on top of her head, you know, she is blinded, just like justice usually is, you know, but she's blinded by a red scarf. And on her head is a red wax cap that is holding a lot of different candles that she's inviting people to light in her performance. So the candles will actually start burning off of her body when the performance begins. And in her arms, she has her arms extended, and in one arm is a match, and in the other one is a matchbox. And on top of her arms is resting a really large Peruvian flag. And within the flag, you know, the Peruvian flag is red, it's white. It's white and red, but it's white in the middle. And the middle part, the white part, it has been burnt 49 times, one for each of the people who were murdered in the protests. And so there's holes that have red wax going through them to signify both the violence and the blood that was spilled through these protests.
Incredible. It is a powerful image. And again, that's why we're going to create a link to this article on our Twitter account. Now, in the first half of our conversation here, you mentioned the issue of public health, and that is profoundly important because in addition to the political strife in Peru during the 1980s, how did the HIV/AIDS epidemic further dehumanize LGBTQ people to the point of becoming, as you mentioned in your article, bodies that produce terror? There are a lot of things in your article that I found very informative, illuminating, interesting. This portion of your article made me a little bit mad because without saying it, it almost sounded like the Peruvian state during that time period was treating LGBTQ people like livestock that you could just kill if there's some sort of disease that spreads out.
Yeah.
That's the impression that I got. I may be wrong, but either way, the way people were dehumanized during that time period because of the HIV/AIDS epidemic is not only just alarming, but infuriating as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's another Peruvian gay theorist. His name was Diego Infante, and he actually theorized a lot about AIDS-related queer death as homicidio, was the term that he invented, particularly to talk about the ways in which the state is negligent towards HIV-positive queer and trans life. Right. So when the epidemic began, Peru was in the middle of the war. And so the situation of not being able to provide medicine was really, you know, made even worse by the war. But it's still going on today. I follow Jivar, which is a group that sort of watches the state's provision of medicine for HIV positive people. And they are telling us that even today, as we speak, there's not enough medicine to provide to HIV-positive people. This is compounded by the fact that Peru, like many African and Latin American countries, get the worst possible treatment for HIV. So instead of getting the first-line medications that are now the standard treatment in Europe and in the U.S. for white people, right, they give these third-world countries the worst kind of medicine, the ones that have the most side effects. compounded with this is the fact that in the 80s, before there was any medicine, and you know, medicine only arrived in the mid-90s with ACT, that was the first medication to treat HIV/AIDS, before there was only palliative care, right? Care that they could give you to sort of ease the passing. But before that, you know, when they started providing medicine, they would only begin providing it to mothers who were expecting mothers. And this was because, you know, unborn children were seen as innocent, but queer and trans people are responsible for getting infected through their devious sexual acts. Therefore, they could only get medicine if they went through a private NGO or some other community organization that was in connected with some type of international cooperation agency that was able to provide a medicine, but the state wouldn't give it. And so what happened during this time, which still happens today when they can't locate next of kin, and for a lot of trans people, that's a huge problem because, again, you're undocumented. So how do you find your next of kin? Or if you've been abandoned by your family, how do you find your next of kin? Right. But, you know, a lot of HIV positive people who died of AIDS would be buried in these mass burial tombs, unnamed.
Wow.
The same way that we have found a lot of the people who were disappeared and murdered during the war. So the kind of ways, the ways that they handled the dead were exactly the same as, you know, the product of war, basically.
That's incredible. As you describe all of this in Peru alone, it dawns on me that the HIV/AIDS epidemic in Latin America during the 1980s should be explored a lot more often than it should. Because if that was happening in Peru alone, it would lead me to believe that various other countries in Latin America with right-wing governments similar to Peru may have been doing the same thing, not under the guise of what was being said at the time, which is the Cold War, the fight against communism, and all this sort of stuff. No, this was an untold war that we may not have known about with regards to LGBTQ people.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned the word deviance right there. Again, characterizing LGBTQ people as deviant is another example of the religious patriarchy that I mentioned in the first half of the conversation here. And it just goes to show you that sometimes the patriarchy can be so eternalized that we could express it without even recognize it coming out of our own mouths sometimes. So I want to go back to Jerma Machuca and how you describe her in the article. She mentioned something here that really caught my attention, which is that she calls herself mestiza, as mm-hmm. you wrote it in the article. But at the same time, she also tells you that she does not really enunciate herself from a place of mestizaje, at least not the kind that romanticizes the displacement of indigenous cultures. I want to know if you can expand on what she was trying to say here, because we don't mention the concept of mestizaje often enough and how it could be a hindrance to various struggles for social justice, including LGBTQ rights.
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. She has another performance, and in a way, you know, she always tells me, like, all my performances are interlinked. But she has another performance called Mestiza Bastarda, which is Bastard Mestiza. You know, she talks a lot about this concept as well, which is this idea that very clearly, I mean, in the image, if you see her, she is a light-skinned person. She's a light-skinned, mixed, multiracial person. But that means, you know, I think when she identifies as mestiza, she's trying to recognize that she is both being, you know, she's marked by being light-skinned, but at the same time, she's also the daughter of an Andean man whose family language was Quechua, you know? And so it is this uncomfortable standing that we have to go through because, you know, race is not the same in the U.S. as it is in South America, in Latin America. You know, it is the opposite. With the ideology of mestizaje, it's if you have one drop white blood, you are white. In the U.S., it's the opposite. If you have one drop non-white blood, you are not white, right? And so I think it is trying to inhabit this uncomfortable position of inheriting all of these weird and uncomfortable ideas around race, but also mentioning that while you recognize that these ideas have impacted the way that you go about the world, that you are not avowing them, in the sense that a lot of people in Peru use this word of mestizaje or mestiza or mestizo or mestice to disavow indigeneity. So when you say you're mestizo, you're saying, yeah, I'm mixed, but I'm more white than indigenous, or I'm more white than black. You know, that's kind of the underlying, the part that we don't say out loud when we say mestizo. And I think when she says, I'm a mestiza bastarda, or I'm a mestiza de todo mestizaje, she's saying, yeah, I am mixed, but I'm not avowing this as an ideology of whiteness. I am the bastard child of this form of racial mixing.
That's incredible. And this is precisely why we do shows like these, because one, we need to have more LGBTQ voices like these. And two, because through the lens of LGBTQ activists like Jerma Machuca, who we've mentioned here, we could see hindrances to social justice that we probably would not have been able to see had we not listened to other voices in the process. So I can't avoid this issue here, which is how a lot of this anti-LGBTQ sentiment in Peru really parallels a lot of what we're seeing here in the U.S. I mean, you're studying here in the U.S. You wrote this for an American publication. I'm pretty sure that it hasn't gone by you that, you know, there's a lot of parallels happening here at this time. And I have to be honest with you, it's been hard to do these particular kinds of shows because there's been so many anti-LGBTQ legislation from state to state in this country that is hard to keep up. And one thing changes from day to day, week to week, month to month in the wrong direction. I mean, do you see parallels to what you've discussed with the history of Peru's anti-LGBTQ sentiment with that of what we're seeing right now here in the U.S.?
For sure. I mean, I think the problem of trans femicide or the murder of trans women, particularly, and trans feminine people, is something that we're seeing all across the world, particularly as it relates to trans women who are sex workers, that I think are amongst the most disenfranchised within the queer community. So like if the queer community is la cola, right, we are behind on all these social movements, trans women and trans feminine people really are la cola de la cola, right? The behind of the behind. And I think this is a situation that is particularly enhanced when we're talking about HIV positive, trans women, black and brown trans women, immigrant trans women. But I see a lot of similarities also with the assignation of this terrorist label, you know, like with what's happening right now with a lot of the immigrant community in the U.S., you know, Trump is invoking all of these acts as if, you know, they're talking about the immigrant community as if they're invading, as if we are invading. And to me, it's the same. It's this idea that, you know, like how can you call indigenous people in their land terrorists? How can you call indigenous people in their land invaders? Right. And I see the same happening with speech, right? With people who dare speak up about Palestine. You know, Mahmoud Khalil and all of the students that have been imprisoned have also been deemed as being, I think the legally is something like opposing or being detrimental to U.S. foreign policy. But it's really just another way of, you know, it's justifying an act of extreme state exceptionalism by putting these people in these prisons where otherwise it would have never held. I mean, this is somebody who has a green card, right? And so I think that these tactics are actually being used, you know, across the world. And with regards to, particularly with regards to trans women, I'm thinking a lot about the ways in which there's this white feminism, you know, kind of weaponizing womanhood against trans people. And to that, I think one of the most powerful tools that we have to respond is to say, like, actually, you know, like indigenous communities have always recognized trans people, maybe not trans, but third gender people, because trans, you know, it's a contemporary word. It's a newer word. That's not the word that everybody uses. In fact, they use travesti in this article because a lot of people don't identify as trans in this like English sort of way. It seemed the same way as queer, right? That's foreign. But, you know, we use travesti, and particularly in Peru, to speak about third gender positionality, we use the word jariwarmi, which is Quechua for men, woman. which is another way of naming that I think, you know, there is a very colonial side to gender. You know, all of these laws that started outlawing queer sexuality and queer genders were actually British and colonial sodomy laws, right? Laws that would forbid people from using items of clothing from other genders. Like, that was not part of Indigenous culture at all. And so I think actually one of the strongest arguments that we have is to sort of go back and say, you know, we have always been here. And in fact, it is, you know, terrorism is extremely colonial, right? And so I think there's nothing more true to our roots than standing together, you know, with trans, queer, non-binary communities who actually, you know, have always been here and have always been here also in a position where, you know, like Stonewall wouldn't have happened without drag queens, transvestites, street queens, as Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera referred to themselves, right? Like, in many, many places, the people who have led revolutions around gender and sexual diversity have actually been trans, queer, and non-binary people. And we would be nowhere without them.
We started this conversation in Peru, but it's quite clear that a lot of what we discuss is universal and can be applied to various other countries around the world, especially here in the U.S., especially during these scary times here in the U.S. As we record this conversation this week, all eyes are on Los Angeles and what's taking place there with the anti-ICE protests that are taking place. Now, I want to end this conversation by actually quoting you towards the end of your article, because you describe Jerema's artwork with the following, quote, "In the global South, these sculptures are part of the colonial architecture of our cities. And in every great mobilization against the government, they are stained with the blood of the people who struggle against the forces of order that insist on using terror as an argument to justify the lethal use of force that they monopolize," end quote. And I'm going to underline monopolize right there. So in these times, this sort of statement is universal and can apply to any political conflict, including here in the U.S. What else do you hope people learn from your article here?
I think something that is really beautiful is how she's inviting people who are mourning Indigenous death and the death of protesters to also mourn trans and travesti death. You know, I think so often these deaths are normalized, like we normalize the death of Palestinians, we normalize the death of sex workers, we normalize the death of racialized peoples, we normalize deaths in the global South as if they didn't mean anything. And so I think, you know, in this performance, she really is lending her body to be a candle for us to mourn all these deaths that we have normalized and should not be normalized. And so this space of actually creating the space for these deaths to matter and for these deaths to mobilize us towards political action is the most important thing.
Absolutely. And we can see it on the news, in social media. And I hope people understand or get the sense of urgency in Malu's voice towards the end here. And with that said, we've been speaking with Malu Machuca-Rose, who is a PhD candidate in performance studies at Northwestern University. Malu's latest article in NACLA is entitled "Cuerpex en Vela, Transvesti Performance Against the Necro State." And we're going to create a link to this article on our Twitter account. But in the meantime, Malu Machuca-Rose, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
Peace, family. on Sunday, June 22nd at WPFW's Jazz and Justice Festival at Malcolm X Park, WPFW invites community filmmakers to join the music. During the festival, in the Josephine Butler Park Center next to Malcolm X Park, WPFW will host a community film showcase celebrating liberatory stories of resistance, resilience, and rhythm. Short works, 12 minutes or less, whether first-time experiments or seasoned productions, will be welcomed for submission at films@wpfw.org. Submissions will remain open through midnight, Wednesday, June 18th. Technical polish is secondary to vision, heart, and voice. This is an open call, and there is space for every perspective that fits under the 12-minute time limitation and reflects our community's values. Once more, the submission email address is films@wpfw.org. WPFW, making the world a better place, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Israel launched a series of large-scale strikes on Iran, targeting Iran's main center for uranium enrichment. Israel also said that it has destroyed dozens of radar installations and surface-to-air missile launchers. Iranian state media confirmed that strikes killed the leader of Iran's Revolutionary Guard and Iran's military's chief of staff. It's being reported Israel also killed multiple top nuclear scientists and an unknown number of civilians. In a televised address, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu described the assault, named Operation Rising Lion, as a last resort to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran, which Israel views as an existential threat. He vowed that the attacks would continue, quote, for as many days as it takes, close quote. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, promised a harsh punishment for Israel's attack, with the IDF later stating that Iran had launched about 100 drones toward Israel. Reaction around the world is one of great concern. NATO Secretary General Rutte said it was crucial for Israel's allies to work to de-escalate tensions. From London, Prime Minister Keir Starmer said, quote, "The reports of these strikes are concerning, and we urge all parties to step back and reduce tensions urgently," close quote. And Rafael Mariana Grossi, Director General of the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, told the agency's Board of Governors any armed attack on and threats against nuclear facilities devoted to peaceful purposes constitutes a violation of the principles of the United Nations Charter.
Furthermore, the IAEA has consistently underlined that armed attacks on nuclear facilities could result in radioactive releases with grave consequences within and beyond the boundaries of the state which has been attacked.
The UN Security Council will hold an emergency meeting requested by Iran later today. As for response in the U.S., today President Trump sided with Israel as he emphasized Iran's failure to reach a deal with the U.S. regarding enriched uranium. Quote, 2 months ago, I gave Iran a 60-day ultimatum to make a deal. They should have done it. Today is day 61. Trump has said that he and his team were aware of Israel's plan to attack Iran. And in other news, a federal appeals court paused a lower court ruling that required President Trump to return control of members of California's National Guard to the state. The lower court ruling found that the administration has not shown that the situation in Los Angeles constituted a rebellion that would justify federalizing the Guard. And Mayor Karen Bass said the nighttime curfew for part of downtown Los Angeles will likely continue for a few more days. Though many of the demonstrations have been peaceful, confrontations between law enforcement officers